You're listening to Extension 720 on the Voice of Chicago, News Talk 720 WGN.
Good evening. We are going to be talking tonight about the Great Conquerors. And the first question, and presenting a necessary question, is why, what motivated them? What in the world was wrong with Alexander to make him Alexander the Great? Why did he feel he had to conquer just about all of the world that lay to the east of the Greek islands? My guests, that's a question we might well begin with John Lynn and Brian Sandberg. John Lynn, an old friend of ours, is professor of history, specialist in military history at the University of Illinois in Urbana. Brian Sandberg is professor of history at Northern Illinois University. What motivated Alexander? The common story we get is he was jealous of his father, Philip of Macedon, who was a conqueror, and Alexander feared that he could not match his father unless he tried harder and tried earlier.
I would go back to Homer to explain that, and I would go back to Greek mythology. I think he had a kind of Achilles complex in terms of really wanting to create a name which would live through the ages. He had the opportunity of simply accepting from Darius the western half of the Persian Empire, and he consciously turned it down. The only thing that finally stopped his impulse was his army mutinied on him in India. So I think that there was an internal drive there for a kind of immortality that could be only achieved by such extraordinary feats.
Alexander's dates are what exactly? We go into the 4th century B.C.
He dies in 323.
323, at the age merely of 33.
33, yeah.
And in those brief years, when did he first lead an army across the Hellespont and over into Asia?
I think that's 334 when he first crosses and frights at Granicus.
Yeah.
So it's
merely
a decade that he has. And he has this boundless ambition, but he also has this military machine that is the Macedonian phalanx, and he has the possibility to use this machine in a way that Philip, his father, couldn't do before. So, I mean, I think it's the pairing of this ambition with the military machine.
Well, let's come to the military side right now. His Macedonian phalanx is an innovation, is it, in the way to fight war?
Yes, indeed. I mean, you have this compact body of men. They're using these long spears, essentially, and you can create a hedgehog sort of block with this body of men and drive forward.
Do they drive forward in the form of a square?
Yeah, essentially a rectangle.
A rectangle.
And so what you have here is a modification of the older Greek hoplite warfare, and one that also can incorporate various other military units into it, to the army, to help it out.
It's interesting. John mentions the Iliad. Well, you mentioned Homer generally, and from the Iliad, even more than from the Odyssey, I suppose they get mythic figures which inspire them, and a mythic history which inspires them to go out and conquer the world. Just as the Achaeans back in the hazy part of Greek history, as told in the Iliad, besieged Troy and ultimately conquered it. And Troy is, of course, on the other side of the Aegean. It's in modern Turkey on the coast. And they decide they're going forward, I suppose, to finish the job that Achilles started.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, and they can draw on the old Hellenic idea of the Aegean is really the concept of Greece. Often people think of Greece as a mainland area, but the Hellenic Greece was, of course, based on the sea. And
the wine dark sea.
Right. But as John has pointed out, Alexander is not content with bounding himself on the ambition of the old Greek idea of the Greek world, but he must go beyond.
In the 10 years or so of the Alexandrian conquest, where did they go? How far did they go? Who do they recruit to join them to expand their army?
Well, very good questions. The basis of his army remained Macedonian, but he also had a number of Greek allies. Greeks by that time are selling themselves as mercenaries. Think of Xenophon, for example. And so he's leaving Greek garrisons behind his Macedonian army. He also must have been using local auxiliary forces as he drives through the mountainous countries well beyond Gaugamela as he's headed for India. Remember, he goes through Afghanistan even, and leaves an imprint there all the way across the Indus River and into India. He is receiving reinforcements, but his primary force is going to be Macedonian. There's the only people he feels can absolutely trust.
How far does he go? He goes into India, not to the tip of India, not down to...
No, he doesn't go south. He goes across northern India, but he doesn't get all the way over to the other side, so to speak, because his army finally says, we've had enough. And without the Macedonian army, he can't go any further.
Of course, his great enemy to begin with, or the man he needs to topple, is the Persian
king.
Darius, who is the head of the Persian Empire. They built a rather sizable empire themselves.
No, a formidable empire, but it seems to have been a bit past its heyday. And this is a question with Alexander, and indeed many of the great conquerors. What sort of enemies did they really face? Were they facing other empires that were really at the top of their game or not? And it seems that maybe in Alexander's case, he also had the advantage, he was lucky to face an enemy that was not really at their top.
East, north, and south, how far does Alexander go at the peak of the establishment of his empire?
I couldn't really tell you exactly.
Well, down
how many
to Egypt.
Miles well, he goes to Egypt. So that's both south and west for him.
Right.
In the Mediterranean, he drives all the way across to India. He conquers up into the hills of Macedonia and across. So he covers an extraordinary area. When he comes back, he's coming up through the Arabian Gulf.
What modern countries are within his control for a while, at least?
You know, obviously, the Palestine, Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and into India, and Pakistan, and into India. Mm-hmm. It's really an extraordinary accomplishment, given the technology of the times. But you made a very good point back there about the Persians themselves. I mean, their great conqueror was Cyrus the Great, and he conquered everything from the borders of India all the way to the Ionian coast of Greece, the Turkish coast of Greece.
In those old cultures that we know of, but whose very spirit we can't really identify with, obviously, when it came to political power transformed into military power, the number of people you killed was an index of your prestige and your importance. Go back to the Old Testament, and we have in it Saul has killed his thousands, David his tens of thousands. Already, there's bragging about how many murders have been done by your men over the putative enemy. How many thousands did Alexander kill?
I don't know, but can I say that some conquerors in that period who boast of those they slaughter are really engaged in a kind of psychological warfare? Certainly the Assyrians were masters of that. They advertised not only those they killed, but those they tortured, etc. And that was probably a way of getting easy victories later down, people who would not risk opposing them because of the terrible fates that awaited them. So you kind of wonder sometimes whether the boasts of victories in terms of their costs are realistic representations, exaggerations by those who observe them, or conscious attempts to cow future enemies.
Early in the 19th century, Percy Bysshe Shelley, as a very young man, and he only lived a very short while, died in his 20s, has this in mind when he writes the sonnet Ozymandias, which I now propose to read to you. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them, and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing besides remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
this is wonderful. Yeah. This is wonderful because it's really inverting, of course, the exact sort of source that would have championed the number of dead created by these great conquerors. Because, of course, the great conquerors, we know much of about them from their own poets or their own literary writers' accounts of their greatness. And, of course, they do try to magnify their feats. So anytime we want to try to understand the numbers of dead that they created, it's tough to do.
Is it not true that in that part of the world, in folk tales and maybe even woven into official patriotic histories, you still get much admiration for Alexandria, just as, of course, we have many cities named for him, one of them being Alexandria in Egypt.
Certainly a lasting impact, I think, of Alexandria's brief conquest, cultural impact especially.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems to me that the great empires that last aren't so much those who are simply powerful in war, but, and I don't want to seem like Pollyanna here, though, are those that are best at incorporating and tolerating those within the empire. The Romans, for all of their military glory, were great forgers of alliances. The Persians the same way, okay? And Alexander accepted those who he conquered as equals in a certain sense.
Well, we come to one of the great Roman conquerors, I suppose in some ways the best, or at least the most fully achieved and the most fully remembered, namely, of course, Julius Caesar. And we'll talk about him and how he bestrode the world like a colossus for a while, after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on the Voice of Chicago, News Talk 720 WGN.
We are examining the careers and the achievements of two of five or six, I guess, of the great conquerors, and the number two refers to the guests tonight, namely John Lynn and Brian Sandberg, both of whom are well accomplished military historians. John Lynn, professor of history at the University of Illinois, down in Urbana. Many books to his credit. One of them, the history of, say the proper title.
Battle, a History of Combat and Culture.
Because I couldn't read my own handwriting here. And most recently, a new book just appeared, Women, Armies, and Warfare in Early Modern Europe. And we'll have to talk about that one separately on another night.
Thank you.
And Brian Sandberg is professor of history at Northern Illinois University and a Ph.D. from the school of John Lynn, I believe.
Yeah.
thus, he's a very good military historian, as is established. In the year 100 B.C., a kid born to a provincial family of the minor Roman aristocracy is from his mother's womb untimely ripped, as Shakespeare describes Caesarian birth. He has the kind of birth which we have named for Caesar, because he was born in that particular fashion. And as we know, he's cut down by his colleagues in 44 B.C. in the famous assassination in the Senate of Rome. In the meantime, for the previous two decades at least, he has conquered the larger portion of Europe. He's even ventured across the Channel and has, for the first time, set the Roman standard on British soil, though it requires reconquest later on for the British really to establish themselves there. So let's look at his achievements. Take us through the Caesarian conquest, Brian, if you would.
I mean, for me, the biggest part of it is the Gallic War. And the conquest of what is today France is so impressive. He's fighting in areas that are very difficult to seize and to hold on to. I've seen Alesia, and it's just an incredible mount there, and conducting a brilliant siege where he has to handle double siege lines, and it's just an amazing conquest.
What's a double siege line?
Well, I mean, you actually have the besieging army essentially surrounded at one point, so it's an impressive feat.
Chris, the most interesting thing is whatever he's doing in France, what he's really trying to conquer is the city of Rome itself. Mm-hmm. He goes off to France as a proconsul, to beat up on the Gauls for really the purpose of creating legions that he can later use against Rome. So it's a rather unusual case there. He does conquer Gaul. He also then, of course, extends the hold out east, although mainly by influencing the rulers there, Cleopatra, we all know about that. But he's really trying to conquer Roman politics. He really wants to become the dictator of Rome.
And finally, he does, of course, marching his legions back into Rome against the official rule, against the will of the Senate. But they yield, and he does become the dictator rather than an emperor. But in effect, he is running the thing on a totally authoritarian basis until they cut him down.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, Shakespeare notwithstanding, they were right to assassinate him.
Yeah. But all the same, once you've established a dictatorship, even if you temporarily end it, it reasserts itself under the name of and in the crowning, though unofficially, of his nephew, I guess. Octavian is his nephew.
Actually, I think it was a grandnephew, but he was a nephew.
Yeah, but he becomes Augustus, the first official Roman emperor.
And a very, very wise politician who recognized that the way to conquer was to seem not to be conquering.
Yeah. what's the nature of Caesarian conquest? He does well in Gaul. He does well against the Germans. He certainly takes Egypt rather easily. What's the military style of Caesarian conquest?
I think here there's a contrast with Alexander. Alexander has a real, you know, heroic form of leadership. Mm-hmm. Caesar is a real politician. So I think the notion of him coming back and conquering Rome is apropos, because he conquers Rome as much through politics as he does through the army. The army's a tool, but he has to be that brilliant politician.
France? What's the nature of the Roman legion, and what does it do?
Well, the Roman legion, I would argue, given the technology, the pre-gun gunpowder technology, is about the peak of Western warfare. The organization, the discipline, the training, the flexibility that was in the legion, so that it could be broken into 10 quite independent parts. You could only use the force you wanted. You didn't have to fight with the whole legion. You could fight on any kind of ground. There was a discipline which could be enforced not only in battle, but on the march, the creation of a fortified camp every night.
The engineering there, too.
Yeah, the engineering is fantastic.
They're developing some pretty heavy weaponry. What's the nature of that weaponry?
Well, they have siege weapons that they can use when they need to fight a siege. But the engineering is not just to be used on the battlefield. It's also for creating roads that allow them to march more quickly, that allow them to move logistical support to where they need it. So it's a very mobile, flexible military machine.
Well, how do you motivate men to undertake all the duress and all the pain and all the risk of death that the Romans did?
Well, I think
they seem to have been quite loyal to Caesar, certainly.
Yes, I think in the Roman case, esprit de corps takes you a long way, but it depends on what Rome you're talking about. Republican Rome was a true citizen army in which people truly did sacrifice for the good of the whole. Once the army become professionalized, about 100 B.C., there is tremendous loyalty attached to the generals, and one of the great accomplishments of Augustus Caesar is to take that loyalty and focus it toward the emperor, no matter who the general is. So that they're very aware of the flow of loyalty, but there is also a tremendous strength in reputation, in the pride in the legion, in the soldier group within the legion that gave it that kind of drive.
Is it fair to say that both for Alexander and for Caesar's legions that finally wars are won by men standing face to face, so to speak, and trying to kill each other? That it's hand-to-hand combat?
Well, yes. I mean, this is direct combat that Caesar is leading, but I think he's really thinking through how he's employing his legions here. And he can be ruthless at times. It's not that he cares for his soldiers in some compassionate way, but he has a bond with them, and he can then rely on them.
But in warfare, before we developed gunpowder and explosives generally, essentially it was hand-to-hand combat that finally turned the trick. Men had to stand there and kill or be killed, and suffer tremendous wounds if they didn't die.
In the Western tradition, in the ancient world, you're absolutely correct. But I want to bring in one other historian who's not sitting at the table. Mm-hmm. He's a very fine historian, mainly of modern wars. His name is Williamson Murray. Works a lot directly in sort of the Washington think tank. And he has a few really good sayings. And one is this, that you can't save bad strategy with good tactics. Ultimately, yes, the battle comes down to the combat, but you can throw that away or misuse it. You have to have a plan. You have to have something that you can accomplish, a goal, a vision, and that is strategy. And a man like Caesar has a very firm idea of what he wants to do. It's almost a plot, so to speak. Somebody like Alexander has perhaps a limitless and therefore somehow unrealistic vision, ultimately, the world, but it is applied in such a way that he can amass this great conquest. The question is, could he ever have held it all?
Something else seems to enter the history of military operations with Caesar. It was there before, surely, but it becomes all the more visible and all the more clear, if only because he confesses it in his great account of the French campaigns, namely a readiness to kill civilians when you've got to, or to kill, for that matter, captured soldiers, and something which Hitler picked up on later on and went him one better. The only way in which Hitler was, in essence, superior to Caesar, he killed more readily and killed even more brutally. We are, and I'm 4 minutes late for an update on the news, but let's turn to atrocity against civilians and against captured military enemy as a theme in the history of conquest itself. Right after, we pause for the news from Jim Gutis.
You're listening to Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on the Voice of Chicago, News Talk 720 WGN.
And back to Brian Sandberg and John Lynn, and to the question of murder as part of conquest. You said something very interesting during the break, John. That's the difference between the way the Greeks handled it and the way the Romans handled it.
Yeah, the Greeks had a tradition of taking prisoners and of ransoming or exchanging those prisoners during or after wars.
Surrender
was acceptable. Greek hoplites fought very hard. But the Romans regarded surrendering as dishonorable. When Hannibal wins his great battle at Cannae, there are thousands of Roman prisoners taken. Those prisoners send a delegation to the Senate to request that the Senate ransom them, and the Senate determines that they are so soiled by their own surrender that they should be sold into slavery by the Carthaginians. They are non-Romans anymore. You don't see the Greeks doing that. You see the Romans doing that. And some of their harshness towards other enemies is really a reflection, as it were, of their own harshness towards their own.
Looking forward to the last of the, quote, great conquerors, Hitler, he managed to starve to death some 2 million Soviet prisoners. Is there a Roman equivalent to that sort of mistreatment of the enemy?
Not that I'm aware of, but
doesn't Caesar order the destruction of whole cohorts of Gauls at some points in the war?
Yeah, I can't tell you.
You find it in the commentaries.
But the fact of the matter is, if the Romans destroy Carthage viciously.
Well, to be sure. And what's that great line from
Carthage, methinks, must be destroyed.
Cartagena delenda est, or something like that.
And when they found an enemy who wouldn't be tolerated, who wouldn't be absorbed, like the Jewish population in Palestine, they would turn vicious. Mm-hmm. And it would became a war of no quarter. When you think of it, that really isn't the normal path for Romans fighting. They're much better at incorporating people. But when they found that kind of an enemy, there were very few limits to what they would do to them.
We have many conquerors to visit tonight, and so necessarily we are hardly doing justice to the rich detail of Roman history itself, but we jump forward. We jump forward to the Mongols, about whom we don't know as much, that is, ordinary people don't know as much as they do if they have already read something about the Romans or even about Alexander the Great. And the particular Mongol who stands out above all the rest is, of course, Genghis Khan. His dates are 1162 to 1227. And he indeed leads the Mongols, an obscure people on the steppes of Asia, leads them in all directions again, and in how many years establishes a vast, vast, though by no means permanent, empire.
The amazing thing with Genghis Khan is just the scale of the conquest. Just, you know, Central Asia.
Very fast ponies that they're on.
Well, exactly. I mean, here you have mounted warfare, and this is a real contrast from the other cases we've been talking about where we had infantry-based mm-hmm. armies. Here you have cavalry-based armies, but of course the expanse of the steppes is just enormous. So organization here to provide food for the people on the move here and for the ponies is just amazing.
And what's the nature of the military assault as compared to the old phalanx system that we had, say, even in Alexandrian history?
Well, here, since it's cavalry, I mean, you're talking about the swiftness of the ability to attack, lots of flanking maneuvers, very quick movements from one area to another, reconcentrating the cavalry.
Are they going up against opposed military who are not mounted?
Well, a lot of the enemies are cavalry, too, but the organization of the Mongols, of their cavalry, is incredible. And they use terror. We talked about terror as a weapon. Here is a different type of terror as a weapon. And Genghis Khan clearly advertised the brutality of the Mongols. We use the idea of the Mongols as a horde, as a scary, brutal group of people today, exactly because that's what Genghis Khan created. He created the idea of them as being brutal to advertise their coming, and it was very effective.
Kill all the men, rape all the women, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, we don't really know how many they killed,
but
they certainly spread the idea that they would do this.
Yeah, We have the image of him as being sort of this leader of this monstrous force, the sort of undisciplined,
well,
almost force of nature.
It's called the Golden Horde.
Well, later it will be. But the reality was that his army was very closely organized, in a decimal type organization. The largest unit was 10,000. Then the next was 1,000. Then the next was 100. Down to 10. It was very, very disciplined. It had a very effective officer corps. It used a combination of light cavalry, who were largely bowmen, but it combined it with heavily armored cavalry for kind of the final crunch. A typical Mongol attack would come in from all directions. There's a lot of talk about that, by the way, now today in American military circles, in terms of this of a tactic of coming in from all directions, sort of making your enemy feel that there's no single thing they can do, that they're assaulted from every point of the compass. But the Mongols were very effective at that. They were also ruthless. There were times when they'd kill any living thing in their way, from rabbit to human being, and then they would use that again as a terror tactic.
Now, how far do they get, and how far do they go, and in what period of time?
Well, they cross all of Central Asia here, and
heading west.
Well, they're heading in multiple directions, different years.
Well, they do, in fact, also take China after a while, and they become the Mongol dynasties of China. But going west towards Europe, how far do they get?
Well, in Genghis Khan's time, I mean, they're in the area that is now Iran. They're in the eastern part of what's today Russia. But it's later successors that actually invade Russia, invade Europe proper.
And they get as far, I believe, in their ultimate extension, as Vienna, isn't that right?
Yeah, they get all the way into Europe, except for Western Europe.
Yeah,
basically, they cut south through what is Iran. If you keep on counting their conquests, the successors, they take over India, the Mughal Empire. Mm-hmm. They're really the most effective military system in history, on land at least, to be sure. They hold, in the sense that they and their successors hold, more of the land mass of the world than any other conqueror I know of. It's a the Mongols themselves have around a 200-year run, but then their successors, Tamerlane and others, will drive it all the way, as I say, through Western Europe. You know, the Turks are essentially an offshoot of the Mongols, and India is then ultimately ruled too. They're going to come in around 1600 under Babur, and they're going to be dominant until the English do them in after 1700.
So this is an empire established by the Khans. This is an empire that, in a way, lasts for a long time, or portions of it last for a long time.
For a very long time. And they stay true to those origins. The court of the Mughal emperor is called the Grand Stirrup. I mean, mm-hmm. Mughal emperor's successors have to be born on a horse blanket to signify this steppe origin of the Mughals, going all the way back to.
We did a program last night with three practitioners of the art of public relations, mm-hmm. on the nature of PR. You need pretty good PR to motivate an army, mm-hmm. to manage a conquest, and then to keep the territory you've gained.
Yes, and with Genghis Khan,
what's the PR message basically?
Well, aside from the terror, which is the negative side of it, the positive side here is that Genghis Khan is the world conqueror. And in billing himself as the world conqueror, this is, again, something that the later successor Mongol empires take up, too. And it really...
You strike terror, you build a reputation as a conqueror, don't you also promise benefits?
Well, I mean, you do try to create a subject population that is going to be... loyal in some way. One of the ways that Genghis Khan seems to have built loyalty was to create lots of children and to build personal ties, mm-hmm. In communities. So very close personal relations with important politicians in the local areas is one way of building that solidity.
So Genghis Khan and those who followed him knew more about how to somehow organize the empire that you've conquered and keep it going than did, say, Alexander.
Well, Alexander, we don't know, and ultimately, because he dies, and then the people who succeed him are though talented, are lesser men and can't hold it together, although one has to wonder whether he ever would. But I agree with you. I think that a conqueror, in order to hold ultimately what they conquer, has got to not only conquer but co-opt. In some way, they have to get elites or people in general, some segment to become part of what they are. Perfect example is the British in India.
Yeah, yeah. Make the case.
Well, in British in India, first of all, they bring peace, peace by conquest to be sure, but peace to a continent, which really had been wracked by war. It's very un-PC to talk about India before the British as being a troubled land, but it was. Even Nehru, when asked when should the British have left, he said after World War I. He didn't say before. He said after World War. Why? Because there really was a coming together. There really, it's hard to talk about an India until the English make an India. Not even the Mughals held it all. Mm-hmm. And there were English elites who were co-opted into the administration of India, who then became agents of it. They also were able to bring in princes, etc., as agents of British power.
We are going to pause in just a moment for the usual reasons, then a great leap forward across time to none other than that fellow born to a minor nobility down in Corsica, of whom not much was expected, but rather unusual achievements were managed in a blazing career. We turn to Napoleon Bonaparte after we pause for these words.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on News Talk 720 WGN.
That's a long fanfare introduction to the Marseillaise. We're coming back to it in full force for a while. This, of course, the song of the French Revolution, but also the song under which the armies of Napoleon conquered the larger part of Europe for a few years at least. Does stir you. You've been singing it as we're going, Charles.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a pretty bloody song.
Oh, yes.
That last part of it says, may we water the furrows of our fields with their impure blood.
Now, yeah. Napoleon didn't fight in the Revolution. Well, maybe towards the very end of it, one could say. Let's come to Napoleon and the Revolution. He's not certainly one of the instigators of the Revolution.
No, definitely not an instigator. But
he's a young guy in a military school.
He's in a military school, and he's an officer, low-level officer of artillery. But he really gets his opportunity in the Revolution, of course, when he gets to play a part in the Siege of Toulon.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's his
What year is that?
This is 1794.
93. Yeah. Yes.
Whereas the French Revolution begins in
89.
In 1789.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's his sighting of the artillery over the city of Toulon, which has been occupied by the British and French people in the area who opposed the revolution, that gives him the opportunity to make his name. Then once he gets his name, he knows how to use this advantage to ingratiate himself with the Directory government a couple of years later.
Of course, what comes between those two points in his early history is the Reign of Terror and the revolution consuming its own, as is often said. And Robespierre and all of those who kill one another for a few years. and finally, stability is required, and he enters as one of the young people who will guarantee a renewal of stability.
Yes, he certainly promises order, promises stability when he gets his chance. But, of course, he takes power in a coup d'etat. So we have to think of Napoleon, I think, as a dictator in the making from an early point.
You mentioned the Directoire, the Directory. That's he is one of the figures in that that constellation of leadership, but he very quickly becomes the prime leader.
Well, he comes in as a consul. He's one of three consuls, and then he's able to make himself first consul. Yeah. That's essentially a dictator. He's a military dictator, and he's taken power in a coup d'etat backed by military force.
The fascinating question, we come to it in a moment after the news break, which comes literally in a few seconds, but then we come to the question of how the revolution related in its in the ideology of Napoleonic conquest to the conquest itself. Mm-hmm. They saw it, or he was able to sell it, as an extension and a defense of the revolution. Defending the revolution, he tries to conquer all of Europe. Just how, we shall observe and we shall detail after an update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on the Voice of Chicago. News Talk 720 WGN.
We return to John Lynn and to Brian Sandberg of, respectively, the University of Illinois Urbana and the Northern Illinois University, both from the history departments of those two institutions, both military historians, among other kinds of interests. And as we come to Napoleon, do I have it right? It's too simple, of course, that he did justify the conquests by the besieged and endangered status that France was in. And for that matter, was France endangered when Napoleon is coming to power?
It is true that he fought campaigns in Italy, northern Italy, when France was endangered before the coup and after the coup. But fundamentally, he was a conqueror. And frankly, I feel not a very good one. He was very good at the battlefield. He was somebody who could win a lot of battles. He did not have a vision of what Europe would look like when it was all done. When I often say to my students, Napoleon didn't have an off button, and he didn't even have a volume control.
We reach the point now in modern history, because this is the beginning, it's early in what we would call modern history, where I must raise, as a psychologist, the question that always interests a psychologist. What the hell motivates a man undertake the kind of career he did, killing hundreds of thousands, if not millions, and never really regretting it, as near as one could tell, but regretting ultimately his fall from power? And what in the world motivates those who so easily are recruited to march along with him and surrender their lives? How are we to understand the conqueror and those who assist him and those whom he murders along the way? Well, we don't have to, there's no trouble in understanding those whom he murders, but there is a great puzzle in understanding the murders that were done under Napoleon's orders, and those who sacrificed their lives for him so readily. How are we to understand that in the case of Napoleon, or later on, in the last major figure we're going to deal with, in the case of Hitler?
Well, a lot of historians have seen Napoleon as really almost a megalomaniac. And there is something to that, I think. He certainly has an unbounded ambition here, but he also very self-consciously sees himself as a conqueror. So he looks back to the ancient models, people like Caesar and Alexander, and sees himself as needing to somehow exceed their conquests. So it's a personal ambition, and he can't be satiated by any of his great victories because there's always one more enemy that he can conjure up. And of course, the British remain his inveterate enemy throughout here. He can't conquer them, and so there's no reason to really stop war. So as long as there is another enemy, Napoleon's ready to go.
Can you conceive that someplace in mid-career, Napoleon, on a dark night, thinking it all over, says, "My God, what have I done? I've killed a million Frenchmen, and Lord knows how many others. Was this really justified? Should I perhaps be somewhat regretful?" Is Napoleon ever capable of that sort of thing?
I absolutely think he isn't. And I think that, you know, in a sense, the conqueror is created by conquest. What I mean by that is that the reputation that draws people to that person, which allows them to literally become a conqueror, must be won by victories, by conquest itself. And you get a momentum of victory. And there's this tendency for some politicians and some generals to see themselves justified in victory, and that simply feeds their appetite for the next military challenge. And you don't even have to go back to Napoleon to find that one. You know, the person who really catches my mind is the person who may use violence, may use war for a specific end to achieve a specific goal, and then once they've got that, they're able to turn it off. And that's an Otto von Bismarck. That is not a Napoleon.
That's also a George Washington.
Yes, George Washington was a flat-out great man. But Napoleon, I think, is a very flawed individual. You could do analyses of him and his brother and his mother and the whole Corsican gang that they came from, and there might be some validity in that. I just find him as a kind of PR genius, a military tactical and operational genius, but a strategic basket case who had implicit in his success his own defeat.
And the defeat, of course, came. It came at Waterloo. Then his long exile, first to Elba, which he escaped from, and then to St. Helena, where finally he died, possibly poisoned with arsenic by the British, who were... that's a hypothesis that has come up only recently, I believe. Yeah,
the person who has pushed that hypothesis died recently. His name was Ben Weider of exercise fame. Mm-hmm. The poisoning was not by the British. The poisoning was from by a member of his own French staff. Yeah. When the French thought that Ben Weider was going to demonstrate that the English had poisoned Napoleon, they gave him all kinds of support. As soon as it was coming out that he had identified this Frenchman as a subject, that support stopped. But what he did is he used the modern forensics. He was a very rich man, so he bought some of the hair of Napoleon. It was quite the thing then to cut the hair, and had it tested in an FBI lab to show that there was serious arsenic poisoning.
So he was poisoned by arsenic.
He was poisoned by arsenic to make him very ill. And then the last thing, and good poisoners do this, they tell me, is you develop this illness, and then the last bit is a different poison that wipes you out right away. But it's seen as being the climax of this long illness.
And who supposedly was?
I forget his name. He was a gentleman of Napoleon's entourage who had brought his wife, and Napoleon apparently had some designs on that wife.
Oh, my goodness.
It's so Napoleon.
I could see that in a special way. That's a wonderful story. If only briefly, because we have to stop for some commercials shortly. What about the Grande Armée? What about what were they militarily that made them so successful for about 15 years?
Well, first of all, it's a revolutionary army that is gradually turned into an imperial army. Mm-hmm. So it's relying on the recruitment and the motivational techniques of the revolutionary period. So you have citizen soldiers here, and you have great organization that have been created by Carnot and others. And then Napoleon.
Do they have a way of fighting which is innovative and particularly solves the military problem the way their opponents haven't yet done?
Well, yes. I mean, they're absolutely able to rely on the loyalty of their soldiers, so they can allow them to do things like operate more freely outside of command and control. That gives them increased mobility and an ability to hit harder, quicker their enemies.
The beginning of what the Nazis later called Blitzkrieg.
Something like that.
To me, the secret of the French revolutionary armies was they developed a tactical system that would allow them to fight in any circumstance on any terrain. Mm-hmm. When 18th century armies had been trained pretty much to stand up in open fields and shoot at one another, there's a lot of qualifications on that, but discipline fire in anywhere from a 2 to a 4 rank deep line was it. So you have this occasion, for example, at the Battle of Jena in 1806, where the Prussians are standing out there in line firing into walls because the French have chosen to find shelter and cover anywhere they could and pop off at the Prussians, who are just winnowed down by that sort of thing. That's simplifying it, but it's not too far from the truth. And the point is that until other armies learned to fight more in a French style or develop something that could counter that French style, they would be in big trouble.
The final defeat, as we know, is at Waterloo. Of Waterloo, Wellington said, as you know, it's a famous quotation, when asked about how they won the battle, he said it was a damn close-run thing, suggesting that Napoleon might have won it, that we were just lucky. But in the long run, of course, he could not have sustained a restoration of the French Empire, could he?
I don't think so, because his previous conquests had really alienated all of the rest of the powers in Europe. So if he had won at Waterloo, it would have been a battlefield victory, and maybe he would have followed up and had another battlefield victory or two. But his opponents had really banded together, and I don't think he could have shaken loose that alliance. They were determined to be rid of Napoleon.
You both know France well and are there often. How do you account for the fact that the French still idealize Napoleon? There's no more sacred place in all of France than Napoleon's tomb at Les Invalides. Why?
Because they're crazy. I love the French, and I love things French, but there is this reverence for this man who caused massive casualties throughout Europe, who left a France smaller than that which he had taken over in 1799 at the coup. Yes, he gave them a sense of tremendous national pride based on an era, a rather brief one, by the way, in which all of Europe quaked before the power of France. but at way, way too great a cost for France and for Europe.
We have some commercials coming in a moment. It is time to invite telephone calls, but I do predict that we won't get to the phones until after the news at 10:30. Still, if you don't mind waiting a bit, you could call in and get your question or comment ready. The number, of course, 312, then 591-7200, 591-7200. If you'd rather reach us via email, the email address, extension 720 at tribune.com. Extension 720, one word, at tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E.com, or 312-591-7200. We return directly after this.
You're listening to Extension 720 on the Voice of Chicago, News Talk 720 WGN.
There's a song that had as much potency as the Marseillaise did for Napoleon. That's the Horst Fesser Lied, which was the marching song of the Nazi stormtroopers before they came to power. And though it wasn't the German national anthem, it remained the song that the military sang. They had many other songs, but this was the key song. And it nerved them up, and they felt they were on a mission to restore civilization to Europe, believe it or not. I don't know whether Hitler believed any of that junk, but again, you had a mass who were taken in and were willing to die, and who also, in their own mind, worshipped a leader whom they saw as not merely charismatic, but as somehow supernatural in his potency. Hitler says more than once in his speeches, you got to do this in German first, he says, alles, was ich bin nur durch euch. Aber alles, was ihr seid, sind sie nur durch mich. Everything that I am only through you. But everything you are only through me. He's announcing a mystical union between himself and the folk, the true people. And he tells them that, and the mission he's got in mind is to go east, ultimately, and kill those lesser races, the Jews, of course, but apart from that, kill the Sklavenrassen, the Slavs, diminish them, kill their leaders, and put the rest of them into slave status, get rid of them, and move Volksdeutsche, Germans who don't have a place to land, giving them Lebensraum, room to live, in the East, so that essentially that becomes the great new German Empire. And they conquered all of that territory.
Yeah, I have no attempted objectivity towards Adolf Hitler. He actually was crazy enough to believe everything he said. At least Napoleon was cynical.
Yes.
He was
an important difference, isn't it?
And the way you could demonstrate that he absolutely bought into his own racial mania is he adopted what you could really see as self-defeating policies in the name of that. For example, his inability to take advantage of the Ukraine as an ally, which he could have easily done against the Soviet leadership. His pursuit of crazy experimentations for sterilization well into 44, which were, for example, what he wanted to do is sterilize the Poles in order that, without killing them, because then you wouldn't have their labor, they would die out and make spaces for this great German master race to move in. The great historian of this era of war, Gerhard Weinberg, who is phenomenal.
Yes. He's been on this program.
We've had discussions on this, and there's just no question that He bought into this when it made no sense in terms of realpolitik to do so. He couldn't even hold it off long enough to deceive people. It was just so fundamental to everything that he was.
Yet, just as the French bought it from Napoleon, the Germans bought it in spades from Hitler, and their great military machine was restored by Hitler, just in terms of putting the money in, and the general staff went for it in a big way, and enthusiastically built that military machine and put it into action. What was the nature of their military operation?
Well, it's a military operation that is combining arms. This is one of the concepts that we talk about, combining different types of military forces together so that the air is working together with the land forces, and it's a very potent military force. But it also had rehearsals, and I think it's very important to note that recent historians have looked at the Polish campaign, for example, in 1939, as a series of mistakes and blunders. So they sort of fine-tuned that military machine then before it was unleashed on France a year later. And I think also the military bought into Hitler's program in part because, as John Keegan, the military historian, talks about, there was a sort of heroic sense to Hitler's mission. In fact, Keegan refers to Hitler as a false heroic conqueror. So he uses some of the Alexandrian sort of mythology to hoax members of the general staff and the officers of the army into buying into this sort of vision.
It's interesting to note that von Stauffenberg, we've recently had the movie in which what's-his-name plays von Stauffenberg,
who did indeed try
to kill Hitler in the famous plot, which failed. That was in the beginning of the war, von Stauffenberg was a very enthusiastic officer and very much given to the Prussian myth of conquest and very much a fan of Hitler's. His main complaint against Hitler was they weren't waging the war properly.
The Germans fight in different ways at different times. Okay, you have Blitzkrieg, the rapid combination of tanks and air power, etc. In 39, 40, 41. In 41, they lose about 75,000 vehicles in that offensive, and they're never able to replace what they've lost, and they can never really devote themselves to Blitzkrieg. You've got the drive on Stalingrad, yes, you do, and there's Kursk in 43, but really the army is turning around, and some of the Russian combinations, for example, their emphasis on artillery, proved to be far more effective later in the war. The Germans really are fighting different wars at different times, even against the same enemies. So there's no one combination. And yes, you are correct. I mean, that there are people who opposed Hitler not because of his racial policies, but because he wasn't winning as much. Winning is its own narcotic. I mean, to play off an old saying, you could say, you know, winning is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
There's so much one could go on to say about Hitler and about the Nazi Empire, which lasted for a good 10, or was it 12 whole years? Depends upon how you want to reckon the chronology. But we don't have time. And shortly we want to pause for some a newscast and then to the phones, 591-7200, and for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. But there's one question I must press right now. Could anything like the madness of conquest, the ambition and the achievement, could it ever happen again, or has the world so altered that it's no longer conceivable, it's no longer feasible?
My fear is not of conquest, but of destruction pure and simple, of the unleashing of the weapons, mainly of the atomic bomb, perhaps initially by terrorists, but it could be worse than that. Or greater than that at the start. I'm more concerned with that. I think there's enough military power of different kinds, of different effectiveness spread around the world. There's enough resistance among local people to being dominated from the outside that the kind of conquest you'd seen in early ages wouldn't happen. But we have greater sins to be afraid of now.
I think that the individual ruler conqueror is probably not very likely in the near future. But the notion of conquest, the notion of armies and military leaders as groups, especially when they're running nation states that have nationalism behind them, they have the potential to carry out conquest, maybe more of a neo-colonial style, but there is that threat, I think.
The last authoritarian ruler who tried to conquer adjacent territory was the once less than beloved Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, fighting Iran. Yeah,
and he got his comeuppance.
Yes. I think there's a difference between...
Not only fighting Iran, but then invading Kuwait.
Yeah, but there's a difference between some conquest and the great conquerors we've been talking about. There's always the possibility for some conquest. My concern would be, is there a possibility for another Alexander, another Hitler? It
doesn't make sense given the way the world works where value really lies.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case, but I think the possibility of massive destruction, of a change in the world from what it is today is, I don't know how likely it is, but it's a very real possibility.
We will be going to the phones and to the email right after an impending update on the news. If you want to call us, move quickly. We've got one or two lines still available. But if you hit the busy signal, just wait a bit, and when we say goodnight to somebody else, try the call again, whether with a question or with a thought you want to share. 591-7200. And, of course, there's infinite room available on the email. The email address, extension720@tribune.com. And with that, to the newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on The Voice of Chicago. News Talk 720 WGN.
And we will be going directly to the phones as soon as I properly reintroduce the guests. They are Brian Sandberg, professor of history at Northern Illinois University, and an old friend, John Lynn, who is professor of history at University of Illinois, and indeed announced here for the first time, is this September becoming, is taking early emeritus status at the University of Illinois, and is becoming professor of history at Northwestern University on a sort of a half-time basis, perhaps. And will be commuting back and forth for a while, but ultimately you will grace the Chicago academic scene.
I hope so.
I'm delighted to have learned it. 591-7200 is the number. As we go to the first call, that comes from Alex here in Chicago. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. In about Napoleon, as I remember, the gentleman who actually poisoned Napoleon, he was actually pushing his wife to get an affair with Napoleon, expecting some money from him. But I think the theory says, or history says, that he didn't give him poison, that the arsenic was in the medicine Napoleon was taking for his stomach. So what do you think about that? And in terms of Hitler, what is your opinion that Himmler excused a genocide, saying we're doing the same what Americans did to the Indians, actually? On different level, definitely. Of course, I don't excuse Hitler and genocide at all. So what will be your thoughts about it?
We shall discover.
Okay. As far as the theory of Napoleon being poisoned, Ben Weider's research is not that it was medicine for his stomach, although the doses of arsenic can be timed to attacks of stomach pain. But that's cause, not effect. I mean, it was the arsenic that was causing the stomach pain. According to Ben Weider, it's a pretty powerful argument. He's written several books on that subject. I will pass the next question on to...
Well, the next question need not concern us. It's in the personal realm of who really killed Napoleon and why, and what did it have to do with his adulterous intentions towards that other guy's wife. These remain... I should think it matters to be adjudicated later on. We are dealing with conquest and the motivation of conquerors rather than their ultimate decline into difficulties with their dwindling entourage. 591-7200 is the number. As we go to, to Joe in Downers Grove. Good evening, sir.
Great show again, Dr. Rosenberg.
Thank you, sir.
I just wanted the panel to address, I believe, two conquerors after Hitler, and there could be an argument either way. One is Joseph Stalin, and the other one is Israel, who acquired quite a bit of territory through defensive means, but they did conquer territory.
Well, one could say of Stalin, he didn't conquer, except he conquered the Russian people, or the Soviet people, more broadly, and managed to kill his many millions as he tried to consolidate power, or God knows why, as he went crazier and crazier. That's another aspect of totalitarian rule, isn't it? Not only outward conquest, but inward destructiveness.
I guess if you wanted to see Stalin as a conqueror, you could talk about the conquest of Eastern Europe, the conquest of the eastern half of the Nazi Empire. But, of course, we often think of those sorts of actions as defensive. And, of course, the great conquerors are thought of as being offensive. So often we look at people who are maybe great generals, but are conducting essentially a defensive war, and we don't really think about them as being great conquerors. But maybe we should think about the definition of conqueror.
From the point of view of the military historian, there's an interesting angle, isn't there, with regard to the Soviet army, with the Soviet military generally. In the great purges that Stalin ran when he was turning apparently rather paranoid, and in which he killed a million or so members of the Communist Party, quite apart from the 30 or 40 million that he dispatched otherwise, including the 5 or 6 million that he condemned to their death in the Ukraine in the very early 1930s. But apart from all of that, in the mid-30s, even while the Moscow purge trials were on, he managed to destroy, literally to kill, just about all of the Soviet general staff.
Well, he certainly did. Tukhachevsky is the
Marshal Tukhachevsky
is the most obvious of those he eliminated, and those who managed to survive, like Zhukov, though a great general, were, shall we say, pandering to him, either because they really believed so or to save their own necks. You know, thank heavens for that Zhukov did survive, because he served to help defeat the Nazis. But I agree entirely with Brian. There are conquerors who see themselves as wanting to stretch their domains, Alexander being a fine example. Napoleon often talked about defense, but I think that he was really involved in expansion. And at the point when the Soviet armies are driving back the Nazis, I really feel that's a response to the Nazis' attack. And yes, they do dominate Eastern Europe, but at that point, I think there's a reason for them to want to create a kind of buffer zone, because they actually, remember, had been attacked in 1914 and then once again in 1941, and living memory gave pretty good warning.
Still, when it comes to genocide or democide, including genocide and yet other categories by which you kill millions of people, Stalin ranks higher than Hitler, according to the work done by a particular political scientist who studied this, spent a career doing it. That is, he literally, if Hitler killed his millions, Stalin killed more millions by the Gulag, by the Ukrainian devastation, and by the purge trials. And in general, he managed to dispatch some 50 or 60 million civilian residents of the Soviet Union.
If that's the correct number, then he does outdo Hitler. But the casualties in World War II are phenomenal.
Oh yes,
and
20 million Soviet military die in World War II.
Yeah, and the guess is that if you take total Soviet casualties, you could be running that up to 40 million. And there are tens of millions who die elsewhere in the world, which may not die from Hitler's direct power, but they're part of that alliance that terrorized the world in the 40s.
Quickly back to the phones. There are some lines available now if you've been trying to reach us. 591-7200, the number. And here is Joe in Gurnee, I believe. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Jack.
Sorry, sir. I'm having trouble reading our board. It's a little dark tonight. Go ahead.
Okay. So this is my question for your callers. Regarding the legacy of Napoleon, I just have often wondered, prior to, for maybe the previous 200 years or so, France was a world power. And then, of course, the revolution came, and then Napoleon, and obviously during Napoleon's reign, they're a world power. But once Napoleon's gone, you have a series of setbacks, like in Mexico, the Franco-Prussian War, World War I, where I realize France was part of the winning side, but they really take a beating. And then, of course, World War II and even in Indochina, it seemed like France never became a real world power again. And I wonder is the, if the, your guest's opinion, is that perhaps part of Napoleon's legacy of so destroying France that they never really came back?
Were they depleted by by Napoleon? Yeah.
Right.
I think there's something to that.
It's a case of alternative histories, obviously.
Right. Well, certainly from the beginning of the 16th century through Napoleon, France was one of the major European powers, and they remain an important European power in the 19th century, but a lot of their victories are more in the colonial sphere. And I think there's also something to Napoleon's political legacy for France. I mean, it's a very disturbed legacy of division. Certainly part of that's from the Revolution, but also Napoleon spawned a certain type of right-wing politics in France that created lots of disruptions. And, of course, Napoleon III comes to power later on in the century as part of the echoes of that sort of politics.
A last stop for some commercials coming up, and then right back to the phones, 591-7200, and to the email, extension 720 at tribune.com. Both are available at this moment.
You're listening to Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on the Voice of Chicago, News Talk 720 WGN.
I should tell you about some things to come. Tomorrow night, we're talking with an eminent sort of public philosopher. That's Robert George of Princeton, and also Maggie Gallagher, who has joined him in an organization very much concerned with the decline of marriage as an institution in America. So it's a conversation about the defense of marriage. On Monday night, we're talking with three people from Scheimer College, which now is located right here in Chicago. It's a great books-based college, and its new president, Tom Lindsay, will be with us together with two other members of his faculty, and we'll talk about the great books with three great bookies from Scheimer College. Tuesday, we've been talking about Nazism lately on this program. Neil Bascom has done a book titled Hunting Eichmann. It's about the search for Adolf Eichmann and then his transport illegally, officially, to Israel and his great trial in Jerusalem and the consequences of that trial. That's Tuesday next week, and more to come. But right now what is to come is a set of additional phone calls on 591-7200 as we go to Chris in Palatine. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen. Good evening. Very interesting show. Two questions. Actually, one question and one comment. I'd heard a quote from Wellington that he said something, paraphrasing it, that he hoped that Napoleon was afraid of his men because God knows he was, which I think had something to do with the fact that the British Army was a conscript army picked up from basically the lowest levels of British society. So I want to know if that was a more or less an accurate quote.
Wellington said a lot of things which could be quoted accurately, but were not accurate. Wellington continually referred to his soldiers as scum of the earth. He did that a number of times. He propagated a view of his soldiers, which he may well have believed, but there is wonderful work that's just coming out now on the British soldier, who in fact was quite a sturdy fellow. He was condemned for being a scum of the earth because during his various campaigns he was so badly fed he could not possibly survive without stealing food. That may have infuriated his officers, but it kept his men alive. In fact, they were very good men. The British Army was something to be proud of.
Okay, and then the other question I had, and more prevalent, this is really speculation. What do you think would have been the history of the world had Napoleon not invaded Russia and decimated his army?
Yes, that's a great counterfactual. If wiser heads had prevailed and told him, you just can't do that.
And that would also reply to Napoleon, or to the Nazis and Hitler, too.
Very same question, yes.
Obviously, historians are hesitant to engage in counterfactuals usually, but if I had to do that, I would really guess that Napoleon's hold on Europe was untenable. Even if he hadn't made the blunder of going into Russia, he had already alienated all of the other monarchs in Europe. He had alienated the nobles within in Europe. I don't see how he could work out a system of power for his empire that was workable. And he also had the ambition. So if he had not been focused on Russia, maybe he would have been focused on invading England, or maybe he would have been focused on heading in a different direction.
Not just consolidating his empire?
Right. I just can't see him applying his mind to that sort of problem. It didn't seem to ever be his real focus.
The last quick question is, I heard Napoleon once said that God was on the side of those with the with the most battalions. Would you agree with that?
He said God favors those with the bigger battalions.
Okay, say
Yeah. I mean, you know, he was being cynical about the power of numbers, but whatever he said, at the end of the day, I think Brian's hit it right. That's almost not a reasonable counterfactual for either Napoleon or Hitler. Because it's just so incomprehensible that they would have stopped and made what the rest of the world would have conceived as a reasonable judgment.
Thank God for irrational despots.
I'm on your side.
Thank you.
We thank you, sir, for the call. Here's an email of considerable interest. Although it is slightly off the subject, I wonder if your guests could address this question. What responsibility did the German people bear for Hitler and his Third Reich? Although Hitler was a homicidal conqueror, he was voted into power legally, and he had the support of a majority of the population almost to the bitter end. And that's the more important part, not that he was voted in, but that they stayed with him almost to the bitter end. What role do the people play in the conquest of monsters like the Nazis?
I believe that the people do have a responsibility for their leadership. It becomes diffused once somebody's at the top and you're just one little voter down at the bottom. But you have to have, you know, the responsibility for those who are elected, even if it's simply that you don't oppose them. Hitler may have terrorized some groups in Germany, but he didn't terrorize all Germans. Germans embraced Hitler, and that's the horrifying fact.
Well, I think part of the problem here is, too, that we rely on nation states in the modern age to bring order to society and stability. But there's an incredible power in nation states. When a people think of themselves as a people and they think of themselves as a people armed in war, then they can get behind a program that maybe they wouldn't support in other times. But they unleash a great power. In war. So the scary thing about the Nazi experience and about the German people's support of the Nazi regime, to me, is that this is a regime that emerges out of a democracy. So even democratic states need to beware of how they use their military power, because once you create an army and put it to the purpose of killing, it may go in directions that the people may not in the end like.
Do we have any cases of that sort beyond the period of World War II? It would be on a lesser scale, I understand, but is there anything in modern history after World War II which suggests a similar process?
Well, I mean, I think if we started to look at cases of genocide, here we're not looking at conquest necessarily, but when you look at the connections between nations and the use of what we might call exterminationist
as in Cambodia,
policies,
or
Cambodia,
Rwanda, and so on.
Right, or cases of severe civil war, like the recent Congo conflict. Mm-hmm. If we look at cases like Sudan, you know, Somalia, where you have a nation-state crumbling, but you have somebody who can appeal to the idea of that nation and has the military machine of a nation-state, a former nation-state, that has potential power to use these sorts of exterminationist policies. Indeed, David Bell's recent book really identifies a sort of exterminationist drive to the modern nation-state, which is dangerous, isn't inherent to all nations, but is possible.
One does have to ask, when it is leaders or when it's actually the people who are doing the extermination. You look at a Rwanda, and it's tribal violence. It isn't some leader alone saying, commit
that.
Oh,
but it was fomented by the Hutu government of Rwanda.
Yes, but then again, it was also acts of those tribal members literally taking the machete in their own hand.
That's what they advised them to do over national radio.
Yeah.
Urged them to do.
That's a bit different than ordering battalions in a disciplined, trained army to do such and such. It's also a difference between an elected leader and tribal viciousness. One of the things that is true of a nation state is the minute you define yourself, you almost always define yourself as better in some sense, mm-hmm. as more worthy in some sense. There is some inferior other that allows you to see yourself as being a nation, and that's one of the ghosts waiting to haunt mm-hmm. any nationalism.
With the idea of the great conquerors, of course, many people focus on the notion of military genius. Mm-hmm. That a great conqueror will have a genius, and it's about their personality, and it's about their ability to win battles in succession. But if the conquerors are dependent on a people and are dependent on some sort of military system, then it can start to question the degree to which that individual conqueror is really controlling the whole process. And I think some of our conquerors, it's more a case of the individual personality, somebody like Alexander who has that will there. And in some other cases, you have a military machine that is unleashed and is outside the control.
With that, we come to the end of the available time. I have enjoyed and profited from this conversation, and I am sincerely in your debt for joining us tonight. And you are, in case you have forgotten, John Lynn, Professor of History, University of Illinois, soon to be the same at Northwestern University, and Brian Sandberg, Professor of History at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. As I said a while ago, we're back tomorrow night with a program about the status of marriage in this country these days. Monday night, we'll be talking with three people on the great books, all of them from Scheimer College here in Chicago. And with that, we wind down for the evening with thanks again to our guests and with thanks to our listeners for some good questions and our best wishes for a most cordial good night.